All right, so here's what we're going to do today. I got several things I want to cover. We're not going to be able to go through all these books by detailed argument, obviously. We don't have time to look at them all. And my purpose in having you read so much is because I want you to be exposed to so much. And I want you to at least have a taste for some of these guys, what they're up to. If I had my way, I'd have you read all of Hunter and all of Lennox, and probably all of Wilson. And they're significant texts, but this way you get a taste for each of them. You kind of know what's going on, and you can say, hey, maybe I need to go a little further. I think I'm going to read more of this guy, and maybe you'll be inspired to read the rest of them. I hope that would take place. I'll warn you, if you decide to read the rest of Lennox, you know, hang on tight. He gets pretty deep and thick, and he's playing science stuff, mathematician stuff, and he's just going wild, crazy. And so what I had you read was actually the philosophical easy stuff, and he gets into the technical stuff as the book goes along. But it's all part of his purpose of showing, hey, these things are not incompatible, and the more you go into the deep, thick stuff, the more it fits. That's his, kind of his thesis. That's his point. But anyway, you got a taste then of these guys. So what we're going to do is we're going to look at each of them, and I'm going to suggest to you what I think are some of the significant, important points that we need to draw out of them and the things that are important for you. If you have questions about any one of the things along the way, like Dan already did, then we'll try to talk about it. I'm going to save Pieper for the last, and we'll see if we get to him. If not, he's pretty straightforward, and you're pretty familiar with that position anyway, as we might usually sometimes call it the boilerplate position. And besides, we want to avoid the Copernican thing. No, we'll get to that. You all read that. Yeah, you all got that. All right, that's why you got to read footnotes. That's where all the fun is. Actually, not even just the footnotes. He puts it right in the text. But we'll get there. So let's start with Wilson. All right, let's start with Wilson, which is one of the newer texts you're reading, a recent book that came out. And this would be the book I'd say, if you're going to read the whole thing, read this one third. I mean, because the other ones are more relevant, I think. This one is going to be stuff you're more familiar with, but he does a really nice job of pulling some things together. All right? And that's really the purpose of this. So I had you read two chapters out of here, and basically what he's doing is he is trying to rebuild a case for a robust understanding of creation. And this provides an excellent place for us to begin, because what I want to preface this day with, because this is the one day in your entire seminary career that I know of where you're going to talk about dinosaurs and were they on the ark and how many days would the creation take place and when did it take place and how long ago and all that kind of stuff. And we're not going to talk about any of that. And this is the one class period we're going to do it, because you see, that's not the point. And if you came to the seminary thinking, man, this is it, you know, I can't wait to get into all this stuff really deep and thick, we're not going to do that. Because it's not really a theological issue that should be that engaging for us. And this means then that I'm not that excited about a lot of the creation research stuff. It has its place, and Lennox and Hunter can hold their own there, but even they are pointing us into some other kinds of issues, and that's what I want us to think about here. So where I want to start is this. If we're going to actually ask the questions about the creation and how do we reconcile that with what's going on in the world we're living in today and what we would call science, we need to start with the understanding that there is more to this creation thing than simply how old is the earth, how long did God take to make it, and do we believe in evolution? And what I'm greatly concerned about is too often when people hear the word creation, and you say, we're going to talk about creation in the church, they immediately go to that. And they immediately think about National Geographic specials, what they saw at the zoo, and you know what they heard from some scientists, and how that really annoys them, and how unchristian that is. And they want to talk about all that kind of stuff. That's about that much of the issue of creation. And when it comes to their lives that they're living, it's about that important. It doesn't matter that much for most of them. Now, some of them, it can become a troubling thing because it might actually challenge your faith. Then you deal with that. That's what we've been talking about before, the whole place of apologetics, and there's a place for that. But the issue of creation is so much more than dinosaur footprints and when they happened and what about Cro-Magnon man and all this kind of stuff. It's so much more, because the doctrine of creation is the whole idea that God has put this thing together with a purpose, and we need to see that great, big, huge, fat purpose and recognize all that God teaches us about ourselves and about our understanding of the world and about our relationship to the world and all that stuff that is embedded in the doctrine of creation. And so I've often taken the habit now of not even using the word creation that much. I prefer first article stuff, Because first article stuff is terminology people haven't heard very much. It's kind of new to them, and you can fill it with more meaning. And when I start talking about first article, I can fill it with lots of meaning, more than just arguments about creationism versus Darwinism or evolutionism. Because there's so much more, and we have to be careful that we don't let ourselves get hijacked into thinking that those are the big issues, and that's what we got to get all worked up about, because those issues aren't the big issues. You with me on this? Now, does all of this mean I don't care about the evolutionary stuff? Not entirely. And I might say things like, it doesn't matter, it's no big deal. Yeah, it matters somewhat, and I care somewhat. And I will readily admit there was a time in my life when I was troubled by these things, and I wondered about, you know, when did dinosaurs live? Were they running around the garden? What's going on and stuff? And I kind of wrestled through this stuff in college a little bit. But I will also say that the older I get, the further I get away from those questions, the less I care. I just don't get that excited about it anymore. I don't think I'd even read a book about it anymore. I just don't care that much. It doesn't matter to me because God created it and it happened. And the more important thing is here we are, and what are we going to be doing with what God has given us to do? And getting distracted by huge questions about either the beginning or the end, which is the problem you get with millennialism and all that kind of stuff, is a distraction. And it becomes a huge problem from paying attention to what we need to be doing instead of getting hung up on these peripheral things. And Bonhoeffer will shed some more light on that when we start getting into him next time around, which will be really fun. Ryan.
I guess my own thing is that, especially growing up in a liberal city, if you can't eloquently defend something of a doctrine of creation, we can say that to us, it's not as important. If you can't defend to them some sort of coherent worldview, especially about the beginnings, they won't listen to anything.
No, I agree with that. Now, the problem you're going to have, though, is this. Even though you can defend, you can present a coherent defense of your worldview, your understanding, if they are a naturalist by conviction, they will not hear you as soon as you branch in God. And it doesn't matter how eloquent you are or how coherent you are, they don't care.
I'm talking more about the people that were grow up in the church and they go off to one semester of college.
Yes.
If you can't defend some sort of reasonable...
Now, that I agree with completely. And that's where you need to have the wide understanding of creation and see how the whole thing starts to hang together. And that's also why I had you read Lennox and Hunter, because those guys are dealing with that kind of stuff. And what they help you realize is, hey, you don't have to be an idiot to believe in creation. And that's the bottom line point. And I agree with you on that. Totally with you on that. But what I'm saying is we can't let the discussion about creation be limited and, you know, and circumvented by only questions about, you know, how did the Grand Canyon get there? Well, it was obviously the flood, and here's the reasons for that. That's not what we're talking about here. That's not the important thing. The important thing is that we are creatures with material bodies, and we have a responsibility toward the rest of creation, and that's what we need to be paying attention to. That's far more important. Okay? All right, so I'm with you on that. That gets back to my apologetic stuff from last time. We've got to be able to give articulate, reasoned, confident answers to the hope that is within us, which includes the fact that God created this world. All right, I'm with you there. Okay, good? So, if you're, you know, just waiting to talk about dinosaur footprints that were found in the mud next to humanoid footprints, sorry, we're not doing that, even though I just did. It's not what I'm excited about. What I'm excited about is this whole concept of what God has done. And Wilson does a nice job of doing that, doesn't he? I think he does. So, a couple things from Wilson. Most important thing is when he's talking about this whole idea of the dialectic. The dialectic of, and what's the term he uses behind that? Of what? The dialectic of the kingdom? Yeah, that's the one I wanted. Yeah, dialectic of the kingdom. And so he's talking about this dialectic of the kingdom. And his point is there are two aspects, right? And his two aspects are?
Creation and redemption.
So these are the two aspects of this dialectic of the kingdom. The dialectic of the kingdom has two aspects, creation and redemption. Now, dialectic is a term you're not as familiar with because you were raised in a Lutheran context. If you're raised in a Reformed context, dialectic, you're all over that. That's Barth kind of language. But in a Lutheran context, what word might we substitute for this which would be just as applicable? How about this one? Tension. The tension of the kingdom. Sound familiar? You had Lutheran mind, you hear about the tension of law and gospel, the tension of two kinds of righteousness, the tension of all these different kinds of things, and we have these theological tensions where we hold these things together. So Jesus Christ is fully God and fully human. There's the tension there. Which one is it? They're both there, full blast. Law and gospel, which one is it? both there, full blast. There's a tension. And so the idea of the tension, we're kind of more familiar with that. We're just trying to hold on to two things at once. And that's the idea with the dialectic. In fact, I think tension's an even better word, even though Wilson doesn't know it, because dialectic implies kind of a back and forth sort of a thing. Whereas the tension, you have both going all at once at the same time, which is exactly what Wilson's trying to describe. So what does he mean when he talks about the dialectic, or I would say the tension of creation and redemption? What's his point? Did you get this? What's he saying? Everybody, take a run at this. Don't make me wait. We got lots to do today.
Yes.
You can't divorce the two of each other.
All right, you cannot divorce the two of each other. That's the idea of the dialectic tension. Okay, what's the content? When are we not divorcing? What do we mean by creation and redemption? What do we even mean by this?
God makes his creation.
All right. So God has made his creation and God redeems his creation. So we're thinking about these two aspects here that are going on. God brings the creation into existence and then God redeems his creation, and it is God's work. So the creation, what we're thinking about primarily, is the material aspect of this stuff. And then the redemption, we're thinking about the idea of the salvific work that is going on. And both of these things are happening concurrently. Now, what Wilson's getting at then is this, that you can't pull these two things apart. You can't pull them apart into like two different aspects of it, where we have, okay, we can think about the creation, now let's think about the redemption. But isn't that exactly what we're used to hearing? So we act like, okay, today we're going to talk about creation. And what do we say? Ark. Well, we'll get there eventually. But 6 days creation, Adam and Eve, snake, apple, okay, got that story? Good. Now what happens? Well, the fall, and now we talk about redemption. Now we're done with that other story. Now we're talking about the Jesus story, the really important one. In fact, that first story exists only for one reason, to tell us why we have a Jesus story. So we got to have the Adam and Eve story to get us to the Jesus story, but the one we care about, that's the Jesus story. That's the redemption story. That's the one we get all excited about. And you might even say it this way. This would be the first article stuff, and then this is all about second article stuff, pretty obviously. So we're doing first article, then we get down to the second article, and it all kind of comes together here. And we have these two separate things. And in most of our circles, if we're thinking about what do we spend our time on, what do we get really worked up about, what's important to us, which one is it? Well, of course, second article redemption stuff. That's the thing that really matters, and that's the thing that counts. And so we get really invested in the redemption story, in the Jesus story, in the second article stuff, and then the creation kind of just becomes a little bit of background. Pay attention to even what Pieper does. Pieper gives us, what, 11 pages on creation? And then how many pages on second article? A whole volume. Volume 2 is Article 2. And creation basically gets a few pages. Now, I know his providence stuff gets in there too, but it's just a little teeny section. He's just covering what needs to be covered. And Wilson's saying, no, we got to recognize there's more going on here. All right, there's a lot more going on here because the redemption creation thing go together. In fact, what we need to recognize is that when God creates, he creates with the plan of redeeming already in place. The creation exists to be redeemed. And the redemption is part of the creation from the very beginning. That's how things work. That there is this creation and the redemption is all into it, and the coming of Christ and then the consummation, it's all part of the one big plan, the economy, right? And then also redemption then plays into creation, because redemption is for what purpose? Exactly, to redeem the creation. It's not as if we're going to get rid of the creation and walk past it, or we're going to leave that behind. No, the whole point of redemption is we're redeeming the creation. That creation that matters. That's why we're doing it. That's why Christ comes. That's why he's doing his work, is for the sake of the creation. They're not antithetical. They're not two separate things. They belong together. Now, Wilson has a pretty nice discussion here toward the end of that first chapter, where he gets into the errors that arise when we start pulling these things apart, or maybe doing only one thing and ignoring the other thing. And this is, I think, pretty useful here. He gets into this whole dialectic and when we mess up the dialectic. And he talks about, this gets even into the second chapter, where he gets into this too, the one Creator, Father, Son, Holy Spirit, and what happens when we leave these things out. And so he starts talking about how if we only focus on one or the other, we run into errors. So what happens if we become only focused on the creation and we ignore the redemption? What ends up happening? What error do we make when we do that? If we focus only on the creation, what kind of wrong thinking might start coming into our Christianity or our confession? All right, God's done now. So God has made a perfect creation and it's all set. It's good the way it is. Okay? What other error might come in? What's that? Well, here's what I'm getting at. I'll just answer my own question since it's too vague for you. If we only focus on the creation, Wilson argues, we end up looking at the creation as either complete by itself and perfect because it doesn't need to be redeemed because we're not thinking about redemption at all, so the creation is just there. And then we can even slide into pantheism kind of things because that world is all there is and it is as it is. And we get that. And then the other problem starts to kick in is we look at that world and we say, yeah, but it ain't the best. It isn't so good all the time. In fact, it's got some big problems in it. Boy, what are we going to do about that? And then what's the solution? The Odyssey. Exactly. And so if we ignore the redemption part, we end up doing the wrong kinds of things. We either think that creation is good and all perfect the way it is, or we see the evil and we end up starting to write theodicies because we're trying to figure out what to do with the mess that's there. Now, I'm going to jump ahead a little bit. This is what Hunter was getting at when he was talking about the Victorian attitude toward the world and towards God. And they're trying to see this perfect world out there. It's just this beautiful thing. You get these glorious, flowery pictures of things. But then there's the rotten stuff. But whose fault is that? Well, that's just people or some of the things in the company. There's theodicies to try to justify this. But they don't ever think about God actively working to redeem this creation and put the whole thing back. All right. Now, if all we focus on is the redemption and ignore the creation, what kind of mistakes do we start to make?
Creation doesn't matter. Start dividing it.
The creation doesn't matter. We start dividing ourselves out from the creation and we start heading off into what sort of teachings? Platonic, or the other word that goes with that would be? Gnostic. Right. So we get either a Platonic or a Gnostic view, and these are essentially the same thing, the Platonic and the Gnostic. So what does that mean when we talk about having a Platonic view? For the sake of our non-philosophers in the room. Yes, Joel.
It means that anything that material is evil.
All right.
And anything spiritual is good.
All right. It's a privileging of the spiritual metaphysical realities over the material, because the material things are mere shadows of greater realities and greater truths. And material things in the long run really don't matter. And then the Gnostics take this even further and say, not only don't they matter, but they're evil. And material things are evil and are rotten and are broken and despicable. And what we need to do is to be freed from those material things, and we go flying off into these heavenly, lofty spiritual realities, which are far above the mere physical things. Because the creation itself is seen to be somehow evil. And that's what happens when we focus only on the idea of redemption. We start getting this idea of a redemption as a rescue operation, whisking us out of this evil world. Sound familiar? It sounds like most of the people in our pews probably believe, because it's a pretty widespread belief. And that's Wilson's point. That's the reason he writes his book. Because he's saying, in the church, we have so divided these and so separated these things out that we don't realize that we're not living in the dialectic of the kingdom anymore, where these are both happening concurrently in this tension, always together. So the creation exists, and it's a broken creation, and God is redeeming this creation, and God is sustaining this creation, and He is actively working to save the creation. So the dialectic keeps us from both of these errors. We don't have to run off into a theodicy, because the solution is Christ, who's making all things new. We don't dismiss the creation as irrelevant, because it's God's creation. And Christ has come for the sake of the creation to redeem that creation. He's invested in it. He cares about it. It's His creation. It matters to Him. Okay. All right. Now, that second chapter in particular should have just been ringing all kinds of bells, because now what Wilson is doing is he's actually pulling in the Trinitarian stuff, and now everything we've been doing all quarter is actually starting to come together. Isn't it? It's a delightful, delicious thing when it all just starts to click, and Wilson is actually saying what's been said and making it all happen. Think back to day one or day two when you came in having read the Gospel of Luke. And remember what was one of the insights I told you? How much does the Gospel of Luke talk about the issue of forgiveness? Virtually non-existent. A couple passing references, and that's it. So in Luke's Gospel, what's the point of salvation? The restoration, the putting things back, the making things right, the societal, creational aspect of the redemption. That's what's going on. And so that's exactly what Wilson's talking about too. So the redemption is happening for the sake of the whole creation. And it's not just that we're getting pulled out of the world, but we're actually being made right for the sake of the world and for the creation that God is bringing back. So all these pieces are coming together here really quite nicely. At least they should be for you. All right. So then at the end, he gets into these errors of what happens. And this is similar to what I was just doing here, where if we leave out the Spirit, or we leave out the Son, or we leave out the Father, we end up running into these errors where we becoming either short-sighted understandings or myopic kind of nearsighted visions, and we're not really seeing things for the fullness of what we should be seeing of what's really going on. And that's his big point. Every once in a while, Wilson gets into a little bit some of his Baptist background stuff on his freedom thing, but we understand that. We're used to that, so we can deal with it. All right, you get Wilson's main point. What questions do you have? What issues are still lingering for you with Wilson? What's going on? What are the questions you've got about that? Jeff?
A small thing. On 72, he says, nowhere in the ecumenical creeds does the church confess belief in the, quote, Trinity. And doesn't the Athanasian, we confess one God in
yeah,
Trinity,
one God in
Trinity and unity?
Yeah, we, yeah.
So is he just kind of speaking too quickly there?
He might be. Besides, he's a Baptist. He doesn't know much about creeds, so he's probably out of his league a little bit. And he's maybe never heard the Athanasian Creed. It's entirely possible. I would say he's just out of
it. I mean, I understand that's not really what he's getting at. But.
No, yeah, you're right. And I would say probably what he's doing is he's thinking Apostles' Nicene, and that's probably the end of it. He's not thinking in the Athanasian Creed. That's where you have a leg up on him. All right, good? Okay? Anything else with Wilson? There's some good stuff in here. And at least it should be making you think a little bit and kind of pushing out your assumptions about some of these things. Yes, Joel.
I just was having a thought when I was kind of reading this. After the creation story, God gives man dominion over the world.
Yes.
And so then I almost kind of saw it with the redemption story when he's teaching his disciples how to be disciples. I almost felt like, again, he was giving us, so he gave us a hand in his creation, and he's given us a hand in the redemption process, and it just kind of gave me chills. I just thought it was just kind of a...
Giving you a hand? What do you mean by that?
He's given us a hand, like he's given us part of the redemption, like the church.
A role to play.
Yeah. And it just kind of gave me chills when I kind of thought like, whoa, that's...
All right, you're starting to get the picture of this, and that's what I mean by getting creation right. It's huge when you get it right, and you're exactly right. So in fact, Aaron now is calling this the First Great Commission, which I think is spot on. First Great Commission is Genesis 1:26, or is it 28? I forget. I think it's 28. I'll have to look. Anyway, where God says, "Be fruitful, multiply, and have dominion over the birds and the fish and the beasts and rule over them." That's the First Great Commission, because that's what God tells Adam and Eve to do. And where in Scripture was that ever rescinded? It hasn't been. That's why we're here. When people ask the question, "What am I doing here?" You know, and they start going, "You're here to serve God with your life." Well, not really. Not really. God doesn't need servants, does he? What's God need from us? Yeah, I'm kind of thirsty. I better make someone to feed me or give me something to drink. Come on. That's this whole point in Psalms. I don't need anything. I don't need your stupid bulls. You know, I don't need all your sacrifice. I don't need that stuff. I'm God. I'm just fine. So why does God put us here to do? Serve him? No. Serve the creation. That's our raison d'etre, our reason for being, is to have dominion. That's why we're here. And then the fall really messes that up, and you're exactly right. The recreation puts things back, so we're able to do what we're supposed to do. And then when we go out into the world and proclaim the gospel, again, God is giving us work to do, part of his redemption work. It's cool. And you start seeing the continuity at all. That's exactly Wilson's point. There's a continuity between these two. They're not at odds, but they fit together beautifully. They complement each other, and they happen simultaneously. That's exactly right. Okay? Good. Anything else here? this law lays down for us then a very important foundation, kind of the framework and context within which we want to see all the rest of this that we're going to be talking about. We need to recognize creation as integral to understand the whole Christian message. And after we get done with Bonhoeffer, for the next three class periods, hopefully you'll get an even better appreciation for this. But see, I'm to the point now of I'm just absolutely convinced that the doctrine of creation is the absolute most important doctrine right behind the doctrine of justification by grace through faith in Christ alone. I mean, that's it. You've got, because nothing makes sense if you get the creation all wrong. You've got to have it right. And we've got to get serious about teaching this idea of God who creates and all the significance that comes out of this, the idea of man's responsibility to the creation, how we fit with the creation, where we fit into the rest of the world around us. All these are issues that come into the doctrine of creation. That's what we're talking about. That's what we're getting into. All right. So we'll let Wilson go. All right. Good enough. We'll do that. Moving along. Now we come to Cornelius Hunter, and let's do Darwin's proof. All right, so what do you think of this text? Now we go from a theologian to a scientist writing about theology.
He writes like a scientist.
He writes like a scientist. I would agree. What do you mean by that, Nathan?
He lacks subtlety.
All right, he lacks subtlety. There's some truth to that. I think there's also a lack of coherence sometimes just in the way he writes. I mean, he gets his ideas out there, but they don't always kind of gel quite the way we might want, and it's just a little bit like this, and this. And so maybe it's a scientist, maybe it's just Hunter. I won't blacklist all scientific writing, but there's a different style here or a different focus. I'll say that. All right, any other quick observations about Hunter? All right, so what did you think? What's the argument he's trying to make? The modernists messed things up. All right, we're kind of used to that story, aren't we? We're getting real used to that. Plaker told us that story as well. But isn't it interesting when you read a guy like Hunter, and he's making the same kind of historical story. He's telling the same story about how things changed and how modernism starts asking different sorts of questions. And that's what we need to recognize. See, modernity is interested in what? What's that?
Rationalism.
Yeah, rationalism is a big thing here. And rationalism is essentially the idea that man has the smarts to figure it out. Man will get it all figured out. Man has the answer. What's that? Yeah, we have the ultimate solutions to the questions, and give us some time, we'll figure it out. That's the idea of rationalism. Modernity is interested in that. Modernity is also interested in truth about things, whatever it thinks the truth is, and it's pretty confident it can figure it out. That's what modernity is interested in. It's interested in this pursuit of these kinds of big answers, looking for these things. All right, so why is that a problem? It only becomes a problem when these things are set over against the idea of what we might call fiduciism, or the idea of fideism, which means what? Faith-based, yeah. Now, these things can both be very negative if we get too hung up on, you know, just blind faith, which is usually the contrast that gets established. It's sort of like it's either we are thinking or we're just taking things on faith. And unfortunately, there are many who come into this camp who have this attitude about these things. And Hunter's trying to say, hey, these aren't necessarily mutually exclusive. All right, now it's also important to recognize that the big complaint that I would have with guys who are getting really hung up on what we might call like creation research kind of stuff or creation science stuff, what's the mistake that they're making? The mistake they tend to make is they are doing precisely these kinds of arguments to try to defeat the godless evolutionists. And so if the godless evolutionists have this kind of answer, I can meet that one with this answer, and then it's just a matter of playing our card game back and forth. And who's got the better hand? And who's going to win the rational argument? And look, I can prove this. And look, you said that. Well, I say this. And you said that. I say this. And then back and forth we go. And we're used to that kind of tete-a-tete. We're used to that kind of, you know, back and forth debate. Now, what's the problem with that? Why not do it? What's wrong with it? Justin. All right, this is Hunter's observation. You end up making assumptions about God or who he is, and we'll get to that more in a minute. We'll unpack that some more. What's the problem even with just doing the idea of, hey, bring on your evolutionists, we're going to play the game, and we're going to win. Come on, let's do it. You're saying the Grand Canyon is millions of years old? No, it's not. We can prove it came from the flood, and it all happened in a couple of weeks. See, here's our evidence, and away we go. Joel.
Thank you. The problem I see with it is you don't let people know you're a disciple of Christ by trying to prove yourself right.
Okay.
Jesus actually says you're going to prove you belong to me by love.
All right.
So if you're just trying to one-up them and say I'm right and you're wrong, I just don't think you're going to...
All right, you're on the right track here. Good. Anybody else? What's the problem with actually entering in this kind of debate between the two set camps, Mike?
I think Hunter makes the argument that it's basically he doesn't use the word theodicy, but what you end up doing is positing a God based on assumptions that can't be proven either way, and so it's a round and round we go. And
all right.
You have to make assumptions that cannot be proven.
All right.
Either way you go.
True. Yes. Anybody else add on? Yes, I'm thinking hard. Yes, Dan.
That rationalism's the rule maker, not God.
The rationalism becomes the real maker?
The rule maker.
The rule maker. Oh, and so in other words, what you're saying is, when we enter into this debate, we're actually playing their game.
Right.
And that's kind of the point I'm getting at. Yeah, right.
Just to throw in a counter opinion, I think a lot of the creationists who are Christians are actually taking the doctrine of creation really seriously, or at least they think they are, because they believe, you know, if God created this world and I examine it, I'm going to find some evidence for that. And I know
correct.
Cornelius Hunter does. His point is just don't overstate your case and play science as if it's a worldview. But I would actually say that some of these guys who do creation research and this and that are actually just trying to put out another option for the public who is just completely sucked into the vortex of evolution.
Correct.
And I think even just having an opposing voice actually makes an argument to talk about.
It can be. But now here's the thing I would say, and this gets back to Plaker's kind of argument, and so we have to think about this, that if we even said, okay, we're going to enter into that debate, we have actually decided the modernist project is worth carrying out.
Well, maybe. But I mean, if God created the world and we believe that it's coherent and that we can...
Yes, absolutely.
I think sometimes they're actually being more, like, having more confidence in faith and what we can find in the world than some of us Lutherans who stand back and just say, let's take everything by faith. Well, faith sometimes goes out and searches.
I'm not disagreeing with that at all. At all. I'm completely with you on that. That I think we should absolutely engage this world, dig into it, and in fact, I say if we get the dialect of the kingdom right, we're going to be very interested in that creation, and we're going to try to learn everything we can about it, and not be afraid of where we go. And that's exactly the attitude I think we should have. However, the goal is not to beat them. The desire is simply to learn God's thoughts after him, or think God's thoughts after him. The desire is to simply give the people in the world a greater appreciation for this incredible creation that God has given us. And we can delight in that and understand it better so that we can have dominion over it better. That's the purpose. The purpose is not to say, look, we're wrong, you're right, and we can prove this, because you're not going to be able to prove God one way or the other, ultimately. And when we get into this idea of trying to do that, we're making the wrong kind of moves. It's falling prey to the modernist agenda, and we don't need to do that. Now, can we offer all kinds of interesting things? Well, yeah, and I think Lennox has great evidence of that. We can. And we can offer, and this is what Odin was trying to get at, we can offer a very consistent, coherent, compelling account of the way things are, which can hold up with any other one and is better because it's the true one, but we're not trying to prove it. See, that's the whole big thing, is trying to prove it. And the mistake that often happens on either side of this creation-evolution debate is someone's trying to prove the other side wrong, and that doesn't need to be our driving motivation.
I just think that sometimes we come off as awfully defensive, as if we only ever critique that which is out there.
Right.
And I actually got in a very spirited debate with a guy who's on the edge of religion and science, and his big thing was, I mean, we're trying to give our best guess. And I understand that I am a philosophically minded person, a lot of theologians are, but that doesn't cut it for a lot of Americans today. And I think just having like some sort of research or this or that we can play counterpoint and actually use as weapons in our
No, it's really useful to be able to say, hey, you know, you're making that position, well, what about that?
Yeah.
And
well, that's all I'm saying.
I agree with that. Okay. Yeah, Nathan.
I think the major thing that is most frustrating or difficult is that they want to look like they're doing that, but in reality, they do have certain premises which are unalterable.
Yes.
And that's not scientific. So even as a science, what we have this evolution hypothesis, we're going to stick with it as long as we can until we have to shift a paradigm.
Right.
But creationists, seven-day flood guys, they can't shift any paradigm out of that. That's the truth. They already know it.
Right.
And it's a matter of just how can we get things to make it look like that's
so it all
right.
fits.
So they're pretending to play that game.
Right.
But in reality, they're still, they have
so the they you're talking about are the rationalists are pretending to play.
No, creation scientists can't.
Oh, are pretending to play the same game they are, but they really can't.
They want to play it, but they only want to play it half-heartedly.
Yes.
They don't want to play by all its rules.
Because ultimately, they have to yield to the Genesis 1 to 3 account.
Right.
And so they aren't able to be.
Commitment lies.
And, yeah, exactly right. That's right.
By definition, science is going to refuse those commitments.
Yes.
Because that is the end of, that's the end of empirical stuff.
As far as they're concerned, which doesn't right. have to be, I would argue.
Well, but I had a question about it, because he says, he quotes several evolutionists who say, point out, once you say design, you've reached the end of explanation, which sounds exactly right, and that he doesn't actually respond to that at all.
Mm, mm.
Can you?
Well, I think I could respond to that, because I would say, once you reach the idea of, you know, creation, that God has done this, you reach the point of exploration. I don't think you reach the point of exploration. You reach the limit at all. In fact, if I say God has done this, I'm more interested in maybe, you know, what are the relationships? Why? How are we this way? So when I start looking at, you know, DNA similarities, it doesn't prove evolution to me. It's just learning more about God's creation. So I don't think it. See, the argument is often made that science will, you know, bring an end, or I mean, religion will bring an end to true science or true discovery, because we'll just be content to say, well, it's the way it is. And I don't think that's true. And historically, it's not been true either. Because, and Hunter makes the point, and Lennox does as well, that some of the best scientists ever were actually motivated by their Christian faith.
Right. But when there's a difference between saying, okay, we can explain this, and here's X, Y, and Z reasons why, and one of those is design. We don't do that because that's contrastive and that puts design as one more thing. So we're still then talking about Y and Z, which are not design, which means it's a hermeneutical problem.
Okay.
That I think, I don't know, that's what gets me most cranky about this whole thing.
Okay.
And I think that's where there's a lot of confusion that it comes up, because people like this aren't thinking hermeneutically and they're not recognizing hermeneutical moves they're making.
Okay.
And so they don't actually know what they're saying when they say, oh, here's design.
Okay, fair enough. I think I'm on track with you, Nathan. I probably need to explore a little more with you, but I think I'm tracking with you. Right.
The sections that Nathan was bringing up, I actually I don't think that that's a problem. I actually think that the statements that the scientists were making, that creation is the end of, it sounded more like a bunch of whiny children that were mad that their hobby was threatened.
Okay.
I mean, it actually wasn't, they weren't scientific, like, statements that they were saying. They were just saying, hey, creation is the end of science. Well, I mean, why? They don't have an answer for that.
Right.
So I actually don't think it's as much of a hermeneutical problem. I think they're being the ones who are just entirely unscientific at that point.
Okay. All right. Now, so let's get back to Hunter's main point. What is Hunter's driving thesis then? What is his driving thesis? What's his point that he's trying to make over these two chapters you had to read? What's he trying to say?
When Darwin's trying to establish an understanding of the world without God, he actually goes and shows that there is God.
All right. His basic argument is this. It is not an issue of religion versus science. That is not the point. That's not what it is at all. And in fact, this I would agree with completely. And in a lot of people's minds, this is the big battle now, religion versus science. And so we have faith versus reason. And that's how it all starts to play out. And this gets perpetuated in the media. This has been the way it's been played out for about 100 years now, since Scopes' monkey trial. I mean, that made it famous, but it was going in before that. This is how it gets played out. You've got obscurantist faith, religion, which is just kind of hanging on to old ideas and superstitions. And we got avant-garde, cutting edge, technologically savvy, reasoned, rational science, on the other hand. So, which side are you going to be on? And this is how it gets portrayed. The media just loves this stuff. And they find these and they try to pull these things out. They like to get into this. And then people in our churches assume it's the same thing. And then people start worrying about science. And they talk about science like it's the enemy. That's not the point. Now, what Hunter is arguing is this. He's saying the real issue that's going on here with the whole Darwinian worldview is actually religion versus religion. And it's not just evolution as a religion, but it's your whole presuppositions and your whole assumptions about God and who God is and what God is. And this is incredibly insightful. And this is why it's important when he talks about what was going on with the whole idea of the Victorian understanding of Christianity. And we can put this Christianity in quotes. Because Victorian Christianity is essentially nothing more than natural religion. Now, natural religion does not just mean going to go out and worship nature, like deer hunters claim to do during November, okay? What natural religion is actually is a technical term for a phenomenon that came to age in the 17th and into the or the 18th into the 19th century. And natural religion was premised on the idea that we're going, and it is an outcome of the Enlightenment. And we've told that story before in here, right? So we all know about that story. And the Enlightenment makes the move of saying man is the measure, everything is about what man can figure out, and so reason becomes enthroned. And natural religion then is the conviction that everything we need to know about God, we can figure out by using our brains. And what natural religion does not rely on is revelation. And revelation then is out as far as revelation, as natural religion is concerned. Natural religion simply wants to use man's reasonable, rational abilities. And when it comes to the man's reason, we make a further distinction. If you think about this, if you've had some philosophy, you know this, between idealism or rationalism or empiricism. Okay, or so idealism versus empiricism. And idealism is the kind of the Platonic, let's think about what's going on out there. And then empiricism is, let's actually study what we've got. And which of the two is the favored one there? It's the empiricism. Let's actually have hard facts. So what natural religion is interested in doing is saying, what are the hard facts? What is the empirical evidence? What are the things that we can study and learn and prove and measure? That's what's real. And what we need to know about God, we're going to figure out this way. That's natural religion. And this is what was going full blast in Darwin's day. He tells that story in here about the painting that was displayed of Jesus in the workers in the Joseph Carpenter shop. What's the point of that story? They didn't like how real it was. They didn't like that Jesus was actually getting dirty and getting cut and kind of like disgusting. And Dickens, our man Dickens, Tale of Two Cities, Christmas Carol. Oh, the Gospel of Christmas, the Christmas Carol. Dickens, what was his response? It's disgusting and revolting. He hated it. Which is, should shed lots of light on things for you guys. Because be really careful. Because you ever paid attention to the theology of A Christmas Carol? The theology is bad. Watch for it. I mean, when you sit down and watch A Christmas Carol, which is part of your Christmas traditions, maybe that's part of yours, maybe it's not. My mother-in-law is really into Christmas Carol. She's got, I don't know, how many different movie versions, and her favorites, and we all debate about which one's best and that kind of thing. Patrick Stewart's still my favorite, but his version of it. So anyway, a bald Scrooge is kind of cool. But anyway, so what's the premise, though? The premise is Scrooge's redemption, which means he's learning to be a good guy. And you also have a lot of this sense of, you know, the goodness and the holiness and the pureness of certain things, and then the degradation and wickedness of other things. And it's just this kind of strong divide. That's what Dickens is about. He has no room for a God who can actually come down and get dirty and actually get involved in stuff. Now, you put that into the context of where the whole evolutionary idea is going on. What's going on here? This is why Hunter says that in the context of natural religion and the Victorian Christianity, Darwin's theory of evolution becomes nothing more than a great big fat theodicy. Why? How is it a theodicy?
It explains how all this came about in the presence of a transcendent, uninterested God.
All right. We can have a God who is clean and neat and above it all, and then all the messy stuff that happens, like, you know, thousands of eggs being laid and only one reaching adulthood, and predation, and, you know, the death, and all these horrible things that evolution proves and we see going on. Well, see, evolution can give you a reason why that's happening without having to involve God. God didn't do that. It just happened because that's how the evolutionary processes took place. And so the horrible things we see in the world can be accounted for without implicating God. So what you're operating with here then is a God who is transcendent and hands off and wouldn't do stuff. Now what Hunter does then, he says, is that attitude, which was in part of the incipient birth of evolution, hasn't gone away. Because to this day, those who are involved in making evolutionary arguments are making assumptions about what God would or wouldn't do. And then he quotes a whole bunch of guys right at the end of his work here that we had to read who are making these same kinds of moves and pointing out that, look, it's the same kind of thing where you see all these weird things in creation. These are in the world. These are the best evidences we have for what God would or wouldn't do. This is page 95. And we, bottom of the page, he writes, these are just quotes from these guys. If God had equipped very different organisms for similar ways of life, there is no reason why he should have provided them, should not have provided them with identical structures. But in fact, the similarities are always superficial. Then we go on. The facts of embryology, study of development, also make little sense except in the light of evolution. Why should species that ultimately develop adaptations for utterly different ways of life be nearly indistinguishable in the earlier stages? How does God's plan for humans and sharks require them to have almost identical embryos? And we go on with this. Then he quotes at the very bottom of the page, like Darwin, Fuchiyama sets strict limits for his God. Certainly God must not offend our sensibilities. As Stephen Jay Gould put it, odd arrangements and funny solutions are the proof of evolution, paths that a sensible God would never tread, but that a natural process constrained by history follows perforce. So what's he saying? He's saying that the reason that people hang on to evolution, and one of the best evidences they have is they say, God wouldn't do it this way. And what should be the answer of a person who actually confesses belief in God?
Why not?
Exactly. Who says God wouldn't do it that way? Why not? Now, implicit in this is the assumption that this is the best of all possible worlds, which is also a very popular idea in the natural religion days. This is the best of all possible worlds, but that's not something the Bible ever says anywhere. That's one of those kind of conclusions you reach a priori. But in fact, we can say that God created the world that exists, and is it the world he wanted to create? Yes. Does it have to be the best possible world? Who says that? It's the world he gave us. And so the way things happen and the way things work in the world, we don't have to try to account for all of them, and we can say, yes, God made it that way. And we can also add, in light of the creation redemption reality, that it is a broken, fallen world. So it's not operating the way it was supposed to anyway, so the brokenness is taken into account without implicating God in some way. Yes, Joe?
To that point, how much should our language be limited in saying this is the way God made it, considering that a fall has occurred?
Exactly.
Some people try to point, well, this was before the fall, this was...
And we have to be really careful because we don't know. What we can say is that the world is not operating the way God had originally created it. It's a broken world. It's fallen. And so the fall extends to every corner of the creation. It's all messed up. But how exactly it's working before the fall, we don't know. And we have to leave that, you know, and just say we don't know for sure. What we do know is it's not working the way that God had intended it. Romans 8 makes that very clear, that the creation is groaning, waiting for the redemption. All right. So Hunter's point then is very simple, that we have to recognize what's really going on here behind this assured results of evolution. And I would add to this one more point that Hunter will make later on, but it's not as clear here. One of the reasons why the scientific community, or not really the scientific community, the agnostic, atheistic community grabs onto evolution is because that's the only thing they've got. See, if it's not a Darwinian evolutionary account for the origins of the world around us, what is it? Yeah, your only other option is intelligent design, or something had to make it. And even if it's an alien come from somewhere else, they don't like that very much. Because intelligent design opens the door wide for the possibility of God, and that's the only choice they've got right now. Because if evolution collapses, the only thing left to take its place is, well, something must have made it then. Whoa, we can't have that. And so they hang on to evolution. And Hunter even talks about how they believe in this against all odds, you know, kind of story. They hang on to it. This is on page 98. And this is kind of captures the whole point of what he's getting at. Right underneath, come let us reason. Darwinism does provide an explanation for natural evil, but it relies on the against all odds story that the species evolved. It is probably the most successful theodicy ever devised, so long as one ignores the underlying absurdity. And it's nice to hear somebody say that bluntly, because, you know, we get the impression sometimes that evolution is eminently reasonable and it makes perfect sense and they've got answers to everything. But in fact, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And there are weird things all over the place. You know, the whole idea of making an upward climb. How can you do that? Upward. What's going on with that? And even to have the idea that we're somehow improving. Once you use a word like improve, you're assuming some sort of standard, which is coming from outside the creation to be able to determine what is better. What do you mean better? More on that in a minute. All right. Anything else with Hunter that you want to debate or discuss or wonder about? Yes, Joel.
So is this kind of what you're, so when we're arguing against the guy that wants to believe in evolution in our paper, you want us to kind of not so much debunk the whole bullets and arguments against evolution, like using, you don't want us to use the rational arguments of why we think it's stupid. You actually want us to get into the...
I think that would be a whole lot more important, yeah.
This is the area that you want us to get into then?
Probably.
Okay.
But I'll give you some more really helpful things in just a few minutes. All right, Nathan.
So am I right in understanding that this isn't about science per se, this is about ideology?
Exactly.
And how then do we not fall into a problem of divorce, of stopping paying attention to creation itself? Because what we're saying is we're more concerned about this atheist versus Christian battle.
Mm-hmm.
But what about the Christians who are scientists who want to do this, like we're going to have an assignment about?
That's exactly what I want. I want to encourage them.
It's a lot more complex because...
It is. But see, now this is where... now let's go to Lennox, okay? So what Lennox is. And Lennox makes the point that 98% of science can just go on merrily without even worrying about these questions. Because they're looking at facts, they're studying things, they're studying actions and reactions, they're measuring stuff, and they're just doing their thing. They don't have to worry about these big questions about origins or where does God fit. It doesn't even matter. It doesn't enter into their work. But you, from an ideological question, you want to say, okay, where am I coming from? Do I believe in God or not? And if I believe in God, does that encourage my science or discourage it? And I would make the argument it encourages it. And that's why when we have a good understanding of creation, it actually encourages it all the more. Because the more we realize our place in creation, our responsibility to creation, our desire to understand how God's creation works because it's God's creation, then we're curious and interested all the more. And that's fine. But it's all done in the context of our assumption and our knowledge that God is the one who put it here. And we don't just kind of say, well, God did it that way and we're content. No, we want to learn more and more and keep on digging. And so I would argue that a really good thorough definition of creation compels the scientist even further forward. And he doesn't have to say, wait, my scientific evidence is proving that God didn't do it. No, it's not even possible, because if it is God's creation, which we confess, then they're going to fit together.
Okay, but let's get more specific.
Okay.
If the scientist's scientific evidence makes the idea of a historical Adam ridiculous.
Okay, what's scientific evidence, though?
The scientific evidence of the field of biology. Like, I mean, what if that's what he feels, and there are Christians who feel that the biological evidence pushes them that way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because that's where it gets, it's not just about, well, did God do it?
Right.
It's, okay, how can we reconcile this book of nature book of scripture?
And that's when we have to say we weren't there at the beginning, and we have to be very careful that we're not making assumptions about what God would or wouldn't do, about the uniformitarian understanding of nature, or about how things work. And then we can start even actually saying things as simple as, could God have created this world with a memory already in place? Well, yeah, you can do that. And just because we say, hey, we have millions of years proof here, well, how do you know that God didn't just build it with already these things in place? Could he have done that? And the answer is, well, yeah, he could have. And so the problem of reconciling the accounts ultimately just comes down to a matter of God can do what God wants to do. And I'm fine with that. And to cut to the quick on this thing, that's where I've come down on this whole issue. Did God create in 6 24-hour days? Sure, I'm fine with that. Why? Scripture says it. I'm cool with that. Is it possible that those days, yom, means long periods? It's possible, but it doesn't really help anything, because even the order things are happening doesn't quite fit. And you're trying to reconcile things that you really don't need to reconcile. And I'm more and more content simply to say, what happened before history started getting recorded, I don't know, and I don't really need to know much. What I know is what God has given me, and that's his work. And I'll take the Adam account and the Eve account, because it's more than just a creation myth, because it's integral to the whole story of creation. And I'll get to that more in a minute. Okay? So you're right. There are going to be some challenges that come down, and ultimately it's going to have to be a matter of what's my guiding premise? What's my ideology? And that's a big thing. And what I'm saying, though, is I think the scientist can keep on pursuing what he's pursuing without fear that he's going to somehow undo his religion. You don't have to be afraid of that. And how we, you know, reconcile the pieces, we'll have to wait and see. And we're kind of in that wait and see process, I think, when it comes to the whole evolutionary thing. And I'll talk more about that in a minute, too.
Well, I've been thinking about this. It seems like when I read the word creation in these books, mm-hmm. I'm reading into it automatically my understanding of, like, okay, 6 days, 6,000 years ago, whatever.
Yeah.
But it seems like actually what they're arguing for is, like, Lennox is just arguing for a mind.
Yes.
Not a totally unguided process.
Right.
I'm just having listened to his lectures and stuff, I don't think that he actually thinks that it's a, you know, quote unquote, literal 6 day, 24 hour, 6,000
Yeah, that could well
process.
Be. Right.
So, but it seems to me that we have a fundamentally different way of looking at this question versus other questions. If people want to argue about how many angels were in the tomb at the resurrection,
mm-hmm.
we say, you're missing the point.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a resurrection and there's a theological point behind mm-hmm. all this stuff. So, what I don't understand is why we feel pushed into a corner to say, this happened in 6 days, 6,000 years ago, and it has mm-hmm. to be that way, and it can't be any other way, and if it is, everything's wrong.
Right. Part of that, the reason some person would say that, is because he's taking a fundamentalist attitude towards Scripture, and he's a biblicist. And he believes that the Bible has to be read the way carefully, and that those genealogical accounts, you can count back and add them up, you get 6,000. You know, the usher kind of dating of things. That, I would say, is a mistake, because you're using Scripture wrongly. You're not using it the way it's intended. And anybody even knows, just look at the New Testament genealogies of Jesus. You got Matthew's account, Luke's account, they're different. And they're not complete.
Right.
They're more representative than they are meant to be a complete genealogy. And so to start assuming that we have complete genealogies all the way back is a mistake of even understanding how the Scriptures work and how we should read them. Now, does that open up billions of years? No. But it does say we need to be a little bit more careful about assuming how old things are. You know, again, like I said, for my own self, I would say I confess a six-day creation. I have no problem with that. When did it take place? I'm less convinced of 6,000 years. I don't think I need to hang on to that. And, you know, I would put it older than that. But I'm not. Also not trying to create tons of time, because God doesn't need tons of time. We don't need millions and billions of years. It's enough for God to create the world, and then it's moving along ever since. And we see the forces that, you know, we can recognize that are working. But even, you know, like glacial things, like you go to the Rockies and, oh, this is a glaciated valley and this happened how many millions of years ago? Well, maybe it did, maybe it didn't. Maybe God created with memory, maybe it is that old. It doesn't really matter. But what we know is that the account of Genesis is not at odds with this reality that we see around us.
Maybe I'm off my rocker, but it just feels like that's a totally different question or a totally different sort of answer that you would give me than if I was pushing you on how many angels were there. You know what I mean? No one's going to get called up on false doctrine charges for saying one or two.
Well, it's because you've got two different gospels saying two different things. And so you can, you know, and you just say, this gospel says this. We know there are angels there, probably two. One was only speaking. That's why only one got talked about in Mark. So we're done with it. And so it's not that difficult. But you might be different. But see, I think a lot of it has to go with your understanding of Scripture, how you're reading Scripture. Are you reading it the right way? And this gets into the whole biblicistic mindset and the fundamentalist mindset that we've got to pay attention to a genre. For example, you don't read Psalms the way you read Romans, and you don't read Revelation the way you read John. You better not.
Right, but even just saying, well, it doesn't open up the door for billions of years. How can we say that?
Well, it could, perhaps. I'm just saying it doesn't need to. I'm not that interested. It could. It could.
I agree that I'm not that interested, but it just feels like our answers are sort of like we're running in a different direction with this issue.
Yeah, fair enough. Now, and there are some reasons why. I'm going to try to get to that here in a minute.
Yeah, sure.
Nathan.
Why can't we go with that and say, and the whole understanding of accommodation, that God accommodates
yes.
himself
and
to
that's,
the
sure.
worldview, this the scientific worldview
right.
of ancient world.
Yeah, yeah. And I don't get that. And that's why we have to be a little bit careful, and that's why I'm going to say I think there are some reasons we have to be a little bit concerned about that, and I'll talk about that in a minute. Ryan.
Our synod just passed some pretty big...
Yeah, 6 days, yeah.
Well, and a pretty conservative view of the short,
Young Earth.
Yeah, Young Earth.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I don't remember reading I didn't read the verbiage.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. Now, Lennox, what's his bottom line? What he's trying to say is science is really good at doing what science does, but some things science simply can't do and it's not qualified to do, and science gets into trouble, or rationalists get into trouble when they start trying to use science for what it's not intended to do. And that's where he has these really two great illustrations. The one of Aunt Matilda's cake, that's a great illustration. So can you learn all about the cake by studying it and looking at it? Yes, you can. Can you figure out what its purpose is? No. No. You have to have Aunt Matilda tell you that. And then you get the staying with the car, you know? So we can learn about how the carburetor works. We might even figure out how the metal was formed, and we might get all these things figured out. Does that mean that since we have all that figured out, there's no Mr. Ford who put it together? No, that would be a crazy assumption to make. But see, that's kind of the assumptions they make, that, look, we can figure these things out, that means there's no God. No, it doesn't mean that at all. So Lennox is very helpful that way. Now, as Adam pointed out, Lennox does not push you to, you know, okay, Genesis is the answer, done. That's not enough. And in fact, that's not even his agenda. He's just trying to say, has the modern scientific worldview proven or disproven God? He's saying, not at all. Not even close. Hasn't done it. And that's all he's trying to say. And what he's really getting at is that this contrast between science and religion is just dead wrong. And we need to fight against this all the time. Because that's the wrong distinction. It's not true. And we need to help our own people see this. They should not be afraid of science. And this gets to Nathan's question. What do you do about a scientist? Tell him to go be a good scientist. Encourage him in his work. Urge him on. And he doesn't have to deny his faith or worry about undermining his faith by what he's doing. He can keep on doing this. That's what Lennox is up to. Lennox is fun to read because he gets all this kind of stuff going in here. And there's a lot of detail. And like I said, it really gets thick as you go forward. But that's probably enough there. Anything else on Lennox you wanted to ask about or question about? Now, the bigger issue then we've got is this. We've got what's going on now is this whole idea of what's called theistic evolution. So a lot of people conclude, in the face of all this scientific evidence and in the face of our confession of faith, what's the solution? Well, obviously God used evolution to bring everything about. Done. And we're set. It seems like a really good, easy solution. A good way to reconcile this, that God used evolution, and that's the way it happened, and we're all set. But there are some things we need to think about that are a little bit concerning. And the first thing we need to realize is, I would contend that the evolutionary mindset, or Darwinian atheistic mindset, is completely different than a Christian mindset on several levels. And we need to realize that. So, theistic evolution would try to reconcile two things. It would try to reconcile the ideas of evolution on one hand and the idea of Christian faith on the other hand. And they're going to try to say, these can fit, no problem. But let's think about this. Evolution would insist that man or creation is continually improving, which is, again, a bit of an assumption because they are assuming they know what improve means or what the environment actually is encouraging. But there's this idea of this kind of upward climb. Man's getting better. Is man better now than he was 2,000 years ago? Yeah, taller, healthier, stronger. We've got proof for that. So it's upward climb. Away we go. And you go back and you can see man climbing out of the caves and he's kind of stupid and now he's gotten better and we're getting smarter and smarter and IQs are going up. And so man is continually improving. What does Christian faith assert about man? Man is fallen and man is incapable. He is enslaved to sin. So he has fallen and he is not improving at all. In fact, getting worse. Left to his own devices, things would unravel. So man has fallen, and he is incapable. In evolution, what do you need then? For man to be able to improve and make things better, what do you need? You just need more time. You need more time, things to fall in the right place, things will work out. Just give me enough time, and things will get better. And every time they need a little more time, they just open it up a little more, just need more time. Time will take care of it all. Just lots of time. In Christian faith, what does man need? He needs a Savior. That's his only solution. What a contrast there is here. So evolution does not need a Savior. Man is just fine. He's taking care of himself. So in evolution, we need to realize this too. Evil, this is a big problem. Evil does not exist. Now we're getting into a philosophical, moral point, an ethical point, but you need to recognize this. Evil is always based on a standard. And if there is no standard of good or bad, then it's just stuff, and it's not evil. In the world of evolution, there is nothing evil. if an entire species gets wiped out because it can't survive, is that evil? That's just survival of the fittest. Which is really weird when you think about it, because sometimes it's the bleeding heart liberals who are worried about trying to save a species. When in fact, couldn't hack it. Get lost, dude. We don't need you anyway. But no, we got to save them all, which is kind of weird, because it's not evil that it happened. Now, this gets even more difficult, because if we really believe in an evolutionary worldview and an evolutionary kind of mindset, then the goal is to keep on getting better and better. So then, isn't eugenics a really good idea?
Yep.
Where we manipulate the gene pool and get rid of the bad ones and the weak ones? It's a really good idea. And then Hitler actually seems like kind of a brave hero instead of a horrible madman. Because you can't call it evil. Evil depends on some standard of don't do that. Like even the rule, do not kill. Well, what's that? That's just arbitrary. That's based on a wrong idea. It's based on superstitions of God. We don't have it anymore. So evil doesn't exist. But for a Christian worldview, evil exists, and so does sin. These are very real things. People just do not come to terms with this. They don't get that. They don't get that if you have a completely rationalistic, materialistic worldview of total naturalism, evil's gone. Doesn't exist. All you have is just emotivism, is, well, I feel, or you ought, and it's just pure subjectivism. It doesn't exist. But over here, evil and sin are real, and what they are is rebellion against natural law. Get my G's and A's in the right places. Against natural law. The idea that God has wired the way things are supposed to be, and we're just fighting against this stuff. So, for science, for evolutionary idea here, there is sin doesn't exist. There is no such thing as sin. There's no such thing as evil. It doesn't exist. It's just not there. It's the way it is. All right, now, the biggest thing of all this then is, in the Christian faith, we have evil and sin. Well, death then, very clearly, is the wages of sin. That's pretty clear. And we're looking not here to an Old Testament weird verse for this, but we're looking to Romans 3 and Romans 6, where Paul's making this very clear that death came because of sin. Kind of a central part of the whole Christian message of death is the wages of sin, and that's what's going on here. And in evolutionary understanding, or a strict Darwinian kind of understanding, and we're talking about a radical atheistic sort of view here, what is death? Exactly. Death is the means of improvement. Death is the tool. In fact, the whole position is predicated on millions and millions of years of lots and lots and lots and lots of death. Death is the ticket, because death weeds out what's wrong and keeps things moving along. And so death is just natural. And this is exactly how you get it in Lion King, the Circle of Life, and in everything you read. Death is natural. It's just part of life. You just have to come to terms with it. It's just what we use. But we would say, no, death is the wages of sin, and death is wrong and is unnatural and is evil. That's how we would look at death. But over here, death is the tool and death is good. To me, this is one of the most difficult things you've got to face with the whole trying to reconcile them. So what you end up with then is we would say that the solution then is the idea of a resurrection from the dead, and this body is resurrected. Over here, the hope is just endless progress onward and upward. That's the only hope. We're looking for a resurrection and a restoration. And over here, the idea is given enough time, we will eventually arrive at some kind of utopia. And then the sun will burn out and it'll all just collapse and we'll just do it all over one more time. That's it. And so life, well, the problem here then is too, is what is the meaning of life? Good question. Yeah, for what purpose? And so why be moral? Why care? Why live? There is no meaning. There's no purpose. There's nothing that matters. It just doesn't matter. I'm just here to propagate the species. So what? I don't want to. There's no meaning. Over here, everything starts to fall into place. You understand who you are, what you're here for, the whole reason of being, the whole Genesis account of the first Great Commission, it all comes into place. Now, what I'm going to argue is this then. Theistic evolution is making a huge mistake because it's trying to reconcile two completely incompatible systems. There's no way to reconcile these two things. And we don't need to be trying to do this. So when we face the question of, well, what about the evidence? Then I think the right answer is to say, well, we'll just see where the evidence goes, won't we? What I am arguing is, sometimes people say that, well, this is just like we did with Galileo and Copernicus. And boy, we got egg on our face that time. We can't let that happen again. So it's time for the church to come to terms with this and get on board with what science is telling us. But this is very different than the whole Galileo-Copernicus thing. Very different. Because there, you've got one text in Joshua where it says that the sun stood still. And they're saying, well, that's what the Bible says. The sun stood still. So therefore, the sun stopped moving and the earth doesn't move, doesn't rotate. It's the sun that's doing the moving. But we recognize that, come on. It's an issue of hermeneutics, because what we have is a phenomenological description of the sun standing still, which is what every one of us would say today, too. If we looked up and saw the sun not moving, what would we say? Oh, the earth has quit spinning on its axis. No, we would say the sun is standing still, even though we might know, if we thought about it, that it's actually the rotation that's stopping. We do the same thing when we talk about a sunset, or the sunset tonight. Well, no, frankly, it didn't. The earth rotated on its axis, and the sun just appeared to go behind the horizon, but it didn't, actually. So it's not a big deal. But when we talk about trying to say, okay, now we got to come to terms with what Galileo taught us, we got to just get on board with science and come to terms with this stuff, be careful, because we're selling the farm way too fast, is my opinion. It's way too early to be doing this, because the scientists themselves can't come to agreement on this stuff. And guys like Lennox and Hunter remind us that there are so many holes in the evolutionary theory that for us to just take it as fact and come to terms with it, it's way premature for all this stuff. We just got to, I think, let the science keep on doing its thing, and in 100 years we'll see where they come down and what they're coming up with then. But the idea of evolution being vindicated, no, it's vindicated only because you don't like the option. And that becomes very clear. Hunter makes it also, he makes the point earlier in his book, he says, is there evidence for evolution? Well, tons of evidence if you have that premise going in. Just like, is there evidence for creation? Well, tons of it if you have that assumption going in. It all depends on where you start.
See, the problem is that, like, at least I'm not reading Lennox or hearing Lennox as arguing with evolutionists. He's
right.
Not arguing with biologists other than on the point that they're saying that it is mindless and that you can completely eliminate anyone causing
right.
this.
Right.
So I don't know. I just don't.
Right. Now Lennox is not going to give you the full Christian account. He's not arguing for that. I think in later pages he actually does, though, pick up some of the stuff even. And you know, if you take him all the way through, he'll pick up more of that. But you're right. His main point is saying that science has not disproven God and has not made God, belief in God, irrational. That's his main driving point. My point is to go even further than what he's trying to say and realize that, okay, we need to come to terms with the incompatibility of these two belief systems and recognize that they are two belief systems. And then the idea of somehow reconciling them with a theistic evolution is really not going to solve anything. It's creating more problems for us. Nathan.
I guess you point out that this is, on the left, you have a radical Darwinian materialistic perspective.
Yes.
But it just doesn't. I'm familiar with evolution, or not biologists who are going to disagree with the central premises there, like that it's improving. Just that they're going to say no, there's an increase or proliferation of complexity, but that may or may not be for good or ill.
Okay.
And there, I mean, you've just got countless Christians, C.S. Lewis, Alistair McGrath, who are going to say, like, no, there's enough evidence here that we can talk about it without going for that whole farm right there.
Mm.
And that seems to push us in the direction where there are lots of people like Lennox who just want to say design, the system looks great, but you just have to show, you have to recognize here that this looks designed. This isn't just chance
random.
Plus
right.
you know, natural selection.
Right, right.
And
right.
that and doesn't seem to me to be the option.
No, I'm saying, and that's why, Sam, you're right. There are layers of complexity here, and there are layers of things to sort out. What I'm saying is you have to be very careful that when we start saying, okay, maybe there are some things that evolved, we have to be quite careful here, because then we also run into problems of anthropology, and we have run into problems of incarnation, because if Christ is becoming fully human, well, what kind of human? At what stage? You know, are we done? Or is humanity still evolving forward? What should we expect? And if you're going to accept, you know, even the small parts, and so I even wonder about, you know, the moves of McGrath or Lewis are saying, maybe you're moving too quickly here and saying, okay, let's just accept this. You got to be careful, because if we're going to confess an incarnation, which is God taking this material reality into the Godhead, well, what point? I mean, well, why does he have to become incarnate if man's getting better, or you know, moving forward? But you would point, maybe not getting better. You know, it's just changing. And we have to be careful about this, you know, the leap between species, because then what is man? And where does the idea of God's original intent of man having dominion fit if man is just the last, you know, appearance in this long vestige of these processes? So there are lots of layers of questions here which are more complicated than simply, what do we mean about our cosmology? Is the sun moving or is the earth moving? It's a lot more than that. And it's a lot more than just, do you believe the Bible or not? So we can't reduce it down to that issue. It's not a slippery slope of, well, you let Genesis go, you're going to lose the resurrection. I'm not caring anything about that argument. That's not the point.
We say in evolution and Darwin, there's no meaning. It's just to propagate the species or whatever. But do we have a meaning on the Christian side?
Well, for life? Yeah, that's the whole point.
What is it?
The meaning of life? Well, you're here because God put you here to take care of the creation. God created because he chose to. He wanted to have this delightful creation, his handiwork. He just, you know, he's an artist, and so he made something, and he made us. And so now our purpose, our reason for being, is to be in this creation and to serve the creation around us. Do your vocation. Yeah.
But he took that away from us when the fall happened.
He didn't take anything away from us. We shattered it. We goofed it up. We got out of the rails where we were supposed to be, but the intent is still there. And our reason for being is exactly what the whole point of Wilson's getting at with the redemption. We're redeemed to do what we were created to do in the first place. It brings us all back.
Just take care of the world.
Do what God put us here to do. Exactly. So, and see, this has huge implications for our eschatology, for example. And this is systems three stuff, and it's all kind of happening at once. So maybe your head is swimming, and that's great. I hope it is. Because if we get this whole idea of creation-redemption dialectic right, then we realize the eschatological hope is not an endless church service. Heaven forbid. You know, you get your harp and it never ends. Oh, no thanks. What the eschatological hope is new heavens and a new earth, and us doing what we're supposed to do. Back in the creation, doing your thing. My chunk of grass, my lawn boy. It's cool. I can handle that. Yeah, I mean, that's closer than the harp thing, guys. It really is. So what was Adam doing? Yes. Taking care of the garden. Pruning trees. Yep.
It's amazing how far, and through teaching Bible classes, how far people don't, you know, people don't realize that. I mean, Christians who are very well educated,
yes,
in church and stuff, they don't understand that. It's a complete surprise,
right,
when you say those things.
Yes. All right, a couple more quick thoughts I want to hit. I'll do this kind of quickly, bullet point wise. A few things I want to cover. John Paul II was another guy who was toying with, you know, kind of, we can accept some of the scientific proof of evolution. I think we need to be careful with what we're accepting. And I guess I'm still holding out. I think it's a little bit early in the game to be accepting these things as definitive. That's just where I'm coming from. We'll see. You know, 100 years from now, maybe it'll be more clear and we'll have to come to terms with this stuff. But I think it's still a little bit early in the game to say, science has proven this beyond a shadow of a doubt. Well, what we see are these things, but what's it proven? For example, you know, homologies. You know, the idea that, you know, you have similar things in different species. We have the pendactyl pattern. You're all familiar? You have five fingers, right? Five toes, the pendactyl pattern. Well, how many bones are in a whale fin? Key bones, five. How many in a bat wing? Five. So the pendactyl pattern holds. You see it in whale fins, you see it in bat wings. So is that proof of evolution? See, this is exactly Hunter's point. You know, if you think that God would, well, obviously there's got to be a better design for a fin than for a hand, so why five? Come on, it's got to be proof of evolution. Or you could just say God's kind of into five. And he used five for the whale, and he used five for the bat, and he used five for the people. So what? What's that? Yeah, he's a high-five God. He's cool. And so it doesn't prove, see, but it doesn't prove anything. Homologies don't prove anything. And just because we see DNA similarities or embryonic similarities, what does that prove? It only proves evolution if you have already believed it. But if you're believing God, you just say, that's how God did it. So what? And I just think it's way too soon to start saying, well, we have this conclusive evidence of these similarities between the DNA chains and structures, so there's similarities. Great. Does that prove common ancestry? Why does it have to prove anything? And so we have to be a little bit careful here what we're accepting.
I think whenever you read some of these articles, like Science, whatever, almost any time they use the word "and therefore," whatever comes next is a massive assumption, not based on the evidence they just presented.
That's true.
It's the leap of the imagination to fill in the blank.
Often the case. Often the case, what you see too, and this is kind of another side point, is evolution so often in the literature starts being treated as the new God spot. They'll talk about how evolution is a tinkerer. Evolution sees that these things happen. Evolution is eager to try new things. And it's like, wait a minute, evolution's not a thing. It's nothing but a theory of chance. And it's not guiding anything. It's not trying anything. It's not purposing anything. There is no purpose. It just happens. And yet, in the desire to try to explain stuff, the therefores, you start personifying evolution, and it starts to actually become something. And that's an issue too. Age of the Earth, I've already mentioned this before. It's a different kind of a question. I would say there is room, even in the Genesis account, for periods of time. And as Adam said, who knows how long? And I would agree with that. There is room there. But I'm just not as concerned about it. And then when you read Bonhoeffer for next time, you can maybe, we'll talk from a philosophical standpoint even more why I'm just not that concerned about it. Issue can never be defending the Bible. And that's probably the biggest mistake I think we get into when we start having the modernist kind of arguments. We're trying to defend the Bible. The point is to simply to proclaim Christ. And that's what we're content to do. We proclaim Christ in the context of his economy of salvation for the sake of creation. So we proclaim Christ. That's what we're interested in. The issue is always Christ. The word Mayim, by the way, and this gets into Pieper a little bit. He talked about, you know, the waters above and the waters below and the firmament in between. And he's like, does it seem strange to have water up there? And he says, well, maybe, but that's okay. We just take it as it stands. And you're thinking, whoa, really? So when the Apollo went up, it punctured and got soaked, you know, and that didn't happen. But Dr. Adams, I've had this conversation with him, he points out, and this is true of the whole scriptural record, that the Hebrew scriptural account is using the words that are available. It's a scriptural words that are available. And mayim, while it can mean water, can also just simply mean undifferentiated matter that's not formed yet. So it's just undifferentiated matter. It's stuff is the idea. So when we even talk about, you know, the tohu wavohu, you know, formless and void, this just mean mayim. There's almost a synonym for this. It's just the undifferentiated matter. And the whole point of creation is that God takes the undifferentiated matter and he makes sense of it. And it starts to matter, and it comes together. So you don't have to overplay these kinds of things. And one of the mistakes that we start seeing with Pieper is also this kind of a sliding in that kind of a bit of a fundamentalistic direction where, well, water is water, and that's that, and Earth is the center because that's what it says, and Copernicus is going to be proven wrong pretty soon. Don't worry about that. Yeah, I know. You kind of like cringe a little bit. It's like, awkward moment. But there it is. So, yeah, it's part of our heritage. All right. Again, secondary causes is not the issue. Some people want to say, well, hey, we believe in secondary causes, so God used evolution as a secondary cause. Well, secondary causes, I am absolutely believing. No doubt about that. God does things through secondary causes. Again, though, the concerns with the evolutionary answer is we have to come to terms with this whole problem of death. And I've heard people deal with that, too. They're talking about, well, it's a spiritual death as opposed to a physical death, and that's the difference. It's a spiritual death that we're talking about. But see, then you get into problems with the whole incarnation and the idea of physical death being the wages of sin. And if it's just a spiritual death, then why the big charade of the cross? And why does Jesus have to shed blood if we're just talking spiritual death? Something's not quite adding up here, because death seems to be physical death, and spiritual death is tied into this, but death is death. And when we start redefining death, then we've got to start to come to terms with things like cross, resurrection, crucifixion, and our Christology starts getting really goofed up. There's a lot more going on here than just, like I said, a couple of verses here or there in the Bible we got to rethink. It's the whole premise of everything. So that's why I'm really reluctant to say theistic evolution is the answer. Do I have an answer that counts for everything? No, I don't, and I'll readily admit that. And can I account for all the evidence of, you know, and probably even more compelling is the astronomical evidence. You know, we start getting ages, you know, light and travel and this kind of stuff. That's even more compelling than the biological stuff. But, you know, do I have answers for all that? No. I'm not too worried about it. And I can always rely on, well, God just put it that way. You know, why not? You know, even the Grand Canyon, does it have to have been created by the flood? Or maybe God just created the Grand Canyon and carved it that way and it was fun. You know, why not? So I'm content with that. What I do know is that when we see everything clearly from God's perspective, it's all going to drop into place. And it's not going to ever be science versus religion. And there, finally, religion wins or science wins. No, it'll just be God wins. It's God's way.